Hello, everybody, and welcome to the extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about Tokyo Godfathers. I'm your host for this one, the Yakuza wedding planner, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today, as always.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and don't make Yukichi sad, Bob.
That's my greatest fear in life. And yes, this month we're talking about Satoshi Kon's Tokyo Godfathers, secretly one of the finest animated holiday movies of all time that you might not have heard of, but thankfully it's very available as of now, and we're going to be talking about it for the next 5 hours or so. Let's say 4 to 5 hours.
Yeah, let's, you know, I got a lot of clips. We haven't finished recording it yet, but I bet the first section was about 90 minutes. So yeah, but we really wanted to do this one. You know, last year we did for the last one of the year, Millennium Actress. This time, an even more seasonally appropriate Satoshi Kon film. And it's a real celebration, both of his life and also the life of the co-writer of the film, the late Keiko Nobumoto. We go a ton into both of their careers, and we learned quite a lot. And this is just such a great, happy movie full of wonderful coincidences.
Mm-hmm. And yes, if we're going to talk about a lot of the movie, go blow by blow through every scene with all the clips and stuff, but you're only going to hear a brief preview of that, about a 45-hour-long preview of that. If you want to hear the entire thing, you have to go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up for the $10 level on the Talking Simpsons Network. And when you do, you will get to access the rest of this episode, and also you get to hear the rest of our What a Cartoon Movie collection, now over 4 years worth of 3 to at times 6 hour long episodes about some of your favorite animated movies. There are far too many to mention here. Some would say there are almost 50 if you do the math.
This is the 50th, isn't it?
I think it is. Yeah. I think it might be, perhaps. I don't know. We're podcasters. That's why we're not good at math. But yes, we've covered like the Disney Renaissance. We've covered things like South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. We've covered other anime like Castle of Cogliostro. Studio Ghibli stuff like Kiki's Delivery Service, and what else have we done? Whisper of the Heart,
yeah, Akira, yeah. End of Evangelion. That was our last one for the cursed year of 2020.
But we're not saying those are Ghibli movies, by the way.
No.
We are intelligent podcasters.
Though, as we say, there's a lot of shared animators, as you'll learn on this podcast too.
Yes, and that's not all. If you sign for the $10 level, you get all the $5 stuff. What's going on there, Henry? What's all the $5 stuff?
My...
Too much to mention, I dare say.
Yes, we just at the end of the 2022 have wrapped up our second season of Blabbing About Batman, the animated series, so you can listen to 8 new podcasts and me and Bob talking about 8 of our favorite episodes of Batman, the animated series. And every month you get a new episode of Talking Futurama and Talk King of the Hill. We go into every episode of that, just like we do The Simpsons as well. You get all those $5 things and a huge back catalog, too, of us covering every episode of The Critic and A Mission Hill. That, on top of the hours and hours of movie podcasts you get, that is totally worth your money at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. So bundle up and grab your milk. It's time for the preview of Tokyo Godfathers. I think we already did a very good bio for Satoshi Kon in Millennium Actress, so please check that out if you want a super in-depth thing on his career, going from being, you know, a fresh-faced young comic artist getting started as an assistant to Katsuhiro Otomo, to graduating into animation, and then becoming this avant-garde director who had more popularity overseas, but still not even that much overseas here, and doing amazing stuff that was, it seemed to be a struggle to make every single time. But to catch you up in the timeline where we are with the Millennium Actress, this is produced while Millennium Actress is sitting on the shelf. So I actually mentioned a little of the production of this movie in our Millennium Actress one, because they finish Millennium Actress. It is first shown in the summer of 2001, but not actually released in the United States until the fall of 2003. And even in Japan, it sits on the shelf for a year until 2002. Meanwhile, Tokyo Godfathers gets released internationally relatively simultaneously in the winter of 2003.
Wow.
As well.
So, I can't believe that.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But since we've already talked a bit about the career, life, and times of Satoshi Kon, then there's two other people I'm going to spotlight in our history here. The late screenwriter Keiko Nobumoto and the still with us animation director Keiichi Konishi. But really, where does this story begin? Why, with Matthew 10 and 11, when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
I'm here for the gold.
Amen. No, when I was a kid, I was like, yeah, I'll just take that gold. You can keep this other stuff I've never heard of.
Frankenstein, is he here?
But yes, that is, of course, I am referencing scripture here from the King James Version of the New Testament. It's the three wise men, as they're known, or the three kings who visit Jesus Christ.
And you're telling me LeBron James wrote this.
Yes. So this is the greatest story ever told. And in Western Christianity, in the actual Bible, I looked this up, only in that section of Matthew are the three kings mentioned. There's no other mention of them in any of the other testaments, and their history grew from there, from just that one bit in Matthew. But
they were like the Guardians of the Galaxy of the Bible.
They are. They're like, they're three guys who show up from the East, which was taken to mean like Persia or even Asia, Asiatic countries. But as you can see, from that translation, a lot of assumptions are made about these guys after the fact.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the song, We Three Kings. Mm-hmm. And it's not Be Stealing the Gold. That's a different version. But yeah. From Orient are. Yeah. So, yes, they're from the Orient. Mm-hmm.
Well, so that's the thing. As I learned from a little bit of research here, it is a very Western Christianity thing to view them even as three kings, because as you'll note from the scripture I just read, a number of kings is not said there. There are three gifts, which has led many tenets of Western Christianity to view it as, well, if there's three gifts, then there's three guys. Each of them has one gift. But in some Eastern versions of Christianity, for example, it is seen as like up to 12 kings who brought those three gifts together.
A posse showed up.
Yeah.
We're talking about like the Eastern Orthodox, like Russian Christianity?
Like that, okay. Yeah, among and Syriatic. I honestly don't know it too well. Okay.
This is animation related, by the way. It's something I had to have to get it out. I recall Animaniacs. There had to be somebody Christian on board on that show, because they just did a Three Kings cartoon. And it wasn't funny.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, this is about the birth of Christ. The Animaniacs are very respectful when they're in the manger.
They don't make a googie face or anything.
No.
Yeah, you're right. That was a very religious one. Yeah. They follow the North Star. They're also, if you're an anime fan, you know the Magi because of the Neon Genesis Evangelion. It's the name of the three systems that run the supercomputer at NERV.
That's right, and also Fist of the North Star.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
He's going to punch that baby. Look out.
So, yes, Matthew also doesn't say the number of kings, doesn't give their names, but through centuries of mainly Western Christian tradition, it is three kings, and they are Caspar or Gaspar, Melchior, and Balthazar.
And you'll see those names in a lot of RPGs.
Mm-hmm, yeah, well, because as we also see in this movie, Christianity is a niche religion in Japan, like not many actual practitioners of it, and a lot of artists for centuries in Japan have looked at Christianity for like, oh, that's interesting. Like kind of how, honestly, how Americans look at like other Eastern religions too, of like, oh, isn't that cute? Yoga is really good for like stretching my back muscle.
Hey, they killed Christian missionaries. And for that, I say hats off.
They, you know, that's how they are still free to this day, I think.
Get that poison out of your country.
But yeah, so the Magi and the story of the three kings have led to many, many parts of what is part of Western Christmas culture. And when I say Western, I mean the American version that's borrowed from the English version, that's taken from Germanic versions, that's just taken from pagans, and it's all a big mess. But for example, if you celebrate the 12 days of Christmas, or just like that song, that is because the January 6th, that is the Epiphany when the Magi arrive to visit Christ after following the North Star.
And they storm the manger?
They do storm the manger on King Herod's message of not wanting a Messiah. But yeah, so that's why the 12 days of Christmas are from the birth of Jesus on the 25th to the arrival of the Magi 12 days later, which again, not in the Bible. This is one of those things that just gets added on to it over time. So that's a quick history of The Three Kings. And then two millennia later, American novelist Peter B. Kind had the marvelous idea. But what if those three kings were a bunch of Old West bank robbers? Well, that's what he did in his short story. I mean, it's called a novel, but it's like, I found it on the Gutenberg, like for free, the Gutenberg website, but not Steve Gutenberg. But but if you were to pay $2 for the Kindle version of it, it's 27 pages on Kindle. Like, it's not a real long
story.
That's
not even a novella. That's yeah. A short story.
But Peter B. Kind wrote this, first published in 1913. It's set during Christmas, and the story follows three men of varying ages on the run from a deadly robbery. Like, they killed people in the robbery. These are bad men. And they come across a woman who is dying in childbirth, and one of her last things is to bequeath the child to them and make them the godfathers of her children, or of her child, and to get that child to safety. And it's set during Christmas, and it is certainly a very Christian story of redemption, of the worst of us, these murderers, when given the task of taking care of a child, are turned better and find their better sides and turn to the Lord, really, to save this kid. And so it's a good story for a story written in 1913. I thought it was pretty good, but it's also a very violent story full of death that has been softened pretty much in every adaptation from then on. It's also interesting because Kine, who I'd never heard of him before, yet you know old books better than me, and you've, I don't think, heard of him before either.
I've never heard of him, and I've got a master's degree.
He was born in 1880, apparently mainly based out of San Francisco, was an early novelist, and also he's really interesting since this is about a very long view version of an adaptation of one of his stories. He was one of the first writers who had a lot of his stories adapted in the silent film era. Like, if you go to his wiki page, over a dozen of his stories get turned into early films. And he lived until 1957, so he actually got to see a lot. Like, he got to see a good dozen adaptations of just his story, The Three Godfathers.
And his most famous character is named Cappy Ricks.
Cappy Rick. I've never heard of this guy either. It's He's no Natty Bumpo.
No.
Now that's a memorable name.
I think he's one of those guys that boxes like this. You're not seeing me, folks. You know what I'm doing.
Oh, we know. We know. Yeah, I'm sure that character had scurvy too. But so yeah, Three Godfathers comes out as a book in 1913. It very quickly gets adapted. Its first official film adaptation is a silent film in 1916. And it is a film of the same title. The star of it is, or one of the stars, is Harry Carey, not the Cubs guy, but the evil senator from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, that mean old man. And in 1919, Harry Carey is also the star of another remake of the story, just 3 years later, called Masked Men. And who directs that but a young man named John Ford? It's one of several Three Godfathers remakes that happen over the next couple decades. For example, in 1929, William Wyle directs one called Hell's Heroes for Universal, which actually Leonard Maltin says he prefers to the John Ford one that I'm going to get to in a second. And I mentioned Hell's Heroes too because it also led to the first animated adaptation of Three Godfathers, because partnered with Hell's Heroes at Universal, Walter Lantz did an Oswald short called Hell's Heels, which also is a story, a version of Three Godfathers starring Oswald and a couple of his pals.
Sort of like how Steamboat Willie is a parody of something no one's ever heard of.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Steamboat Bill Jr., I think.
Right, right.
With Buster Keaton, right?
I think you're right. Yeah. Wow. I totally forgot that. So yes, after a couple world wars, it's 1948, and John Ford is getting wistful in his older age, not only because he wants to remember his youth of directing Three Godfathers adaptation, but also because in 1947, his good friend and who he worked with a ton, Harry Carey, passes away, who he really enjoyed cigarettes. Cigars, Harry Carey. So I think you can figure why he died before 70. So John Ford, as a tribute to Harry Carey, wants to remake it again, this time with John Wayne in the lead. And the youngest member of the group of the Three Godfathers is going to be played by Harry Carey Jr., making his big screen debut. So it's a really sweet tribute to him, though, as Leonard Maltin mentions in his review comparing Hell's Heroes and the Three Godfathers with John Wayne, he's like, it almost becomes too sentimental. They soften the guys too much. They're not as evil guys, you know. He seemed to be of the opinion, like, if in Christmas Carol you soften Scrooge too much, then his redemption's not as interesting, and so they're not as bad of guys. I don't think they even kill people.
I guess it's because it's a code movie, right?
That's right. Haze the code. Ones I was talking about, like Hell's Heroes was one of the, it was a pre-Haze Code Western, so they could get much more violent, so yeah.
Yeah, and also, so yeah, it's a John Ford movie, it's a John Wayne movie. I don't think it's a well-known movie. Mm-mm. I consider myself someone who knows more than most people, the average person knows about movies because I do this for a living, and I watch a lot of Turner Classic Movies. And I feel like this would be like a Wednesday at 2 a.m. on TCM. They're not putting this in the primetime slot. It's like, oh, it's a lesser John Wayne.
I know. I was shocked that it wasn't on Blu-ray or in an HD edition on like HBO Max, because Warner owns it, though it was one of those ones that, like, it's an MGM film that then Turner bought the MGM library, so Warner owns it now. But it is in color. It was big budget for its time. It's John Ford and John Wayne. Like, this is not a B picture. Like, this was an A picture of its time. Like, this was the big Christmas movie of 48.
I got to say, to complain about streaming platforms, we do that a lot on these podcasts, but the classic movie selection on streaming platforms is abysmal. These companies could just drop all of their catalogs, or most of them, but normally it's just like, we'll give you the five most famous classic pre-1970 movies we own. Seek the rest out yourself, and you have the basically Dollar Tree checkout lane version of this.
I do.
And it's crazy. It's like the Universal, just throw a bunch of 50s and 60s crap on there, 30s and 40s. But maybe, I don't know why, maybe they think, oh, if someone finds this on accident, they'll be driven away. They're like, oh, what's this black and white crap?
I accidentally watched some musty old bullshit. I'm not watching this. Yeah,
And I hate that TCM is like a cable add-on channel. I want them to have their own streaming channel I can just watch on my own.
Yeah, it's it also should be a deeper selection in HBO Max, but they're only taken away from it now. So, you know, I watched Meet Me in St. Louis with my mom, stepdad, and husband last year as our old-timey Christmas movie watch, and now I wonder if that's even on there anymore. That's why, yes, I bought the DVD of Three Godfathers, because it's you can pay to rent it on, like, YouTube, but I want to bring the DVD with me to watch with my family at Christmas time, because my stepdad likes his Westerns, and I mean, a Christmas Western starring John Wayne, directed by John Ford, that has stepdad written all over it.
In SD. Is it like in 4x3?
It was shot 4x3, I think. So I don't want to say that for sure, but I think it was. But yeah, so Three Godfathers, like you said, hardly the most famous John Ford, John Wayne movie, though it is more of one of their secondary films, like, but a true movie buffs know it well, and that includes the late Satoshi Kon, who, as we talked about in Millennium Actress, Satoshi Kon is not what you'd call an otaku for, like, anime, but he is just loved film, like, not just Japanese film, but international film. Loves it. Like, and so, of course, he had heard of the Three Godfathers and was pulling from that mainly, and I believe the John Wayne version the most. I even saw people point out, like, this type of story is so famous. Like, Three Men and a Little Baby is kind of this story, too. And also, just a year before this comes out, Ice Age is also this same story.
Oh, you're right. And by the way, the baby was little, but the lady was little in the title.
Oh, right, yes.
The baby was of average size.
Okay, it was Three Men and a Baby, and then a little lady.
A little lady.
That's right. But, so yes, Satoshi Kon, what's going on with him when he gets to this? Millennium Actress completed, waiting on a release date from DreamWorks. He's trying to think of what to do next. And, yes, the scripting will begin for this in late 2001. And so after Perfect Blue, he didn't really want to directly adapt anybody else's work again, though Paprika was later adapted from a novel, but he's wanting to do more of his kind of own thing. And also, after doing two films that blurred the line heavily between fiction and reality, he didn't want to do that again. He wanted to challenge himself with it. This is from a fans translated 2004 interview with him on the subject. To put it bluntly, I have no choice but to trust myself. I felt it was interesting at the time with that feeling. Through the process of creating a work, I often come to my own inner inevitability as to why a particular work was created, but this is only after the fact. In the case of Tokyo Godfathers, I think that it can be said I got tired of the methodology of the previous two works.
Okay.
And yeah, in several other interviews too, he said he took inspiration from living in Tokyo and seeing that Tokyo in films doesn't feel like actually walking through it. That's one of the most impressive things about this movie, is by being not real but imitating reality through how it portrays Tokyo, it makes it a realer than real one. It looks how it feels to walk around in Tokyo, as opposed to just filming like a documentary or even a live action film in Tokyo would.
Yeah, you're going places where most movies set in Tokyo won't go,
yeah,
or can't go.
Yeah, and you know, I wonder if it's, I could not find anything about this, but Nagoshi, the director of Yakuza, 2 years after this film's release is the first Yakuza game, and I see so many similarities with like all of the weirdos you meet in the Yakuza games, and how a lot of the games, like the unhoused, are a big part of them too, especially the seventh game. And also a big chunk of this film, not just Tokyo, but it's Shinjuku as well, which is the setting for the main starting point of Yakuza games too.
And the first one is about a baby.
Yeah, it's also about a baby, as is six about a baby too, with an unlikely guardian for that baby. So, yeah, I just wonder, the whole time I was reading about this, I was like, man, was him and Nagoshi just in the same, you know, realm of thinking? Or, I mean, because in the timeline of Yakuza, he was working on that as an idea long before Tokyo Godfathers came out in Japan in late 2003. But it's similar settings and styles, I'd say. And he wants it to be about the people who are often overlooked in that world, especially the homeless. Like it is a borrowed word in Japan to say homeless. If you watch it in Japanese, if you're not a Japanese speaker but you know English, you will hear them say homeless, homeless over and over again to describe the unfortunate unhoused.
Yeah, I mean, appeal for me in this is that it's also true of America, but especially in Japan, is that all the media is so youth focused. You can't tell stories about anyone over in Japan, maybe over the age of 23. And even then you're pushing it. But in this one, it's like two middle-aged people. One of them is transgender. One of them is just a drunk gambler, and the one younger character is like a chubby girl. And you never see larger, overweight characters in anime unless the joke is they eat all the food.
Yeah, that they're a disgusting, gross person, and you should hate them or mock them. Yeah, it's all about looking at the people who never get stories told about them. And unfortunately, I do think, after the lack of success of this one, it probably didn't help their stories get told more. But especially like to Cone really wanted to deal with, in Japan, they really don't like talking about their unhoused people. Like they, especially in how it's marketed as a tourist destination, especially Tokyo sells itself as like, oh, it's so clean and so safe. And so this film shows you like, there are garbage-filled alleys in Japan.
Yeah.
There are the homeless people you never see or that they don't want you to know about. Like,
I mean, I was there for a little under 2 weeks. I think I saw one unhoused person. And usually on my way over here, I see between 3 to 5.
Yes, yeah, yeah. No, I remember in Akihabara, it was the one time a homeless guy came up to me and asked for money, and I gave him some money, too. And he asked in English as well. That's why I was like, oh, hey, okay. But yeah, it's... it is less likely to be talked about than even here. Like we do live in, unfortunately, a very a place, like one of the most economically unequal places in America is San Francisco, and full of the horribly treated unhoused population here.
We just made it legal for robots to explode people. So,
And of course, it's only, yeah, I mean, there's just so much like human suffering every second you walk around San Francisco, and it's so horrible. And, you know, my test of if somebody sucks is if they move to San Francisco and they say, like, can't somebody do something about these people? Like, just the hatred of even seeing an unhoused person. Like,
it's a good litmus test.
Yeah. It's like those people don't do it by choice, guys. They're also, you know, Do you know how it's impossible for you to own a place around here? I bet these people used to rent places and can't anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but so Satoshi Kon wants to focus on all that stuff, and including having a transgender woman as one of the leads in the film, which we'll get to that too. We're going to talk about it and how times change. But first, I want to talk about another reason he wanted to write this was so he could once again work with his friend Keiko Nobumoto. Let's talk a little bit about the late Keiko Nobumoto. We've covered her some before, but I really want to focus on her. One thing I'm sad to say is, like, there are so few English language interviews with her, and even fan translated ones from Japanese. She just doesn't give a lot of interviews. It's at least that I could find. Please, if you know of them and I missed them in my Googling and wikis and all that, please send them my way, because I would love to read more of her. But I can't tell if in the interviews I've seen with her, she's usually part of a round table and doesn't do as much of the talking. And I can't tell if it's, you know, she could just be a person who doesn't want to talk much during interviews or let the writing speak for itself. Though also I wonder, as one of the few women in a very male-dominated world, especially of Japanese animation, if she just didn't have the space to talk about her craft some. I wonder. For example, I learned a teeny bit about her from watching a 2018 roundtable of her and many of the other creators of Cowboy Bebop came to the New York Comic Con to do like a 20th anniversary thing. It was really cool, but she didn't talk all of that much. One of the only things I learned from it was she was talked about her childhood, because she mentioned that, like, oh, you know, it's great to see how big the show is in America, you know, because me growing up, some of the first American stuff I watched was Sesame Street, and it meant a whole lot to me. And so I love that that something I worked on can be so big in America. So Keiko Nobumoto, born on Hokkaido Island in March 13th of 1964, and she would grow to be one of the most influential writers of Japanese, like, television and movies in our lifetime, I would say. One of her earliest entries into the world of screenwriting came in 1987. She was one of the first graduates of Anime Scenario House, which was a training. I wouldn't call it a college exactly, but it definitely was a training program created by Takao Koyama, who was a writer of a million episodes of Dragon Ball Z and many other things. And so, like,
I just love Anime Scenario House. They're at it again.
She is a scenario writer on a lot of things, which is a term you really only see in, like, anime or video games from Japan.
Yeah.
Which I believe in general, the scenario writer is more like either a head writer or you wrote the Bible, the story Bible for it. Like, that's what the scenario person
is. We never get those credits here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, only if it's a borrowed one from, like, an import, a Japanese import. Yeah. That, like, they still credit people like
things
that.
Like scenario writer and planner, things like that.
Yes,
we don't
really
get those in English language credits.
Which, that, you know, when you read planner as an American fan, you think, like, oh, so they, like, manage people's time or told, like, took care of the schedule. But yeah, she learned from Koyama, who, like, if you look at his credits, he's the screenwriter on, I think, most of the DBZ movies. Like, if it wasn't based on Toriyama's direct comic, a lot of the time he was the guy heading up, figuring out the stories for that. She got into screenwriting in her early 20s thanks to that. In the early 90s, she even won Fuji TV's Young TV Scenarist Award, or scenarist, like the scenario writer thing, which... that also in 1991 led to, I believe, her first professional contact with Satoshi Kon. I mentioned in Millennium Actress, Katsuhiro Otomo did a live action film he directed called World Apartment Horror.
Right.
Satoshi Kon came up with the concept and they worked on the comic version of it together. And Nobumoto co-wrote the script with them. And I think several of her jobs were, you know, great artists like Kon or Otomo, they want to start from a script. They're not being crazy like Hayao Miyazaki of, like, I'm just going to board everything. I'll figure it out as I go. So these guys who need a script before they storyboard, people like Nobumoto would work with them to hammer out the script together that could then be turned into the storyboard that would come later. And she was a huge part of writing on that. And that's where she first worked with Cohn. Cohn would later call her like an old drinking buddy. I mean, friend who's a great writer. Like, but so they've been pals for a while. Though 1994 was a major moment for Keiko Nomomoto. There's a ton of stuff of hers we've never seen because they're like live action Japanese dramas or books of hers that haven't been translated, but she's written a ton of stuff that isn't anime. If you just look at her IMDb credits that are like localized anime in most cases, you would think like, oh, she wrote like five things in 30 years or something, but she wrote far more than that. But her big break, at least internationally for fans overseas, was when she was hired by Bandai Visual as the lead writer on their major sequel series, Macross Plus. The high-end OVA basically takes Top Gun and puts it in the Macross world, but with much more deeper emotionality. And like, people all credit Nobumoto for that. Like,
that's where she began working with Watanabe?
Yes, it was her first time working with two of her best collaborators, Shinichiro Watanabe as the general director and Yoko Kanno as the composer. Hmm. And yeah, if you watch Macross Plus now, if you've never seen it, and I would bet you probably haven't seen it because it's been out of print for way too long. I think it's finally getting a Blu-ray thing. I got to see it in a theater last year.
I was going
to
ask about that. I remember it being in a theater.
The movie version, which I'd never seen. I'd only seen the OVA version, not the film version, which is, so it came out as OVAs first, and then they redid a few scenes and just put it all together as one 2-hour movie. Hmm. And it's great. And if you watch it as a Cowboy Bebop fan, you're like, you see how this style of work they did together matured into Cowboy Bebop or led to it. So while working in 1997 on a live action drama called Those Were the Days, or Hakusen Nagashi, in 1997, she was brought on board with her previous Macross Plus pals to bring her sense of humanity and grounded emotion and to make it legendary, or say a new genre unto itself, as the advertisements called it. And apparently the name comes from her. She is the one who named it Cowboy Bebop.
There's only been two series in the Cowboy Bebop genre so far.
It's only those two. Yeah, we said it a million times, but Cowboy Bebop, every time I watch it, I'm like, no, it is that advanced. It's still that great. I still love it. There is still nothing like it. It is a new genre unto itself.
And like all of Cohn's works, I mean, Cohn didn't work on that, but like all of Cohn's works, Cowboy Bebop, nobody liked it. It lost money and not popular at all.
Yeah, yeah. In
Japan, initially.
In Japan, yeah. In all these cases, we're talking about things that like only became international successes, like were not a big deal in Japan. Like, I'm not saying nobody watched them, but they were seen as niche titles. It's like, you know, finding out that like Wes Anderson movies are way bigger in Japan than they are here, which I don't think is the case. But yeah, Nobumoto, like something about her style, like she was the lead writer on the whole thing, the scenarioist, if you will. And she, I mean, the characters of Bebop has amazing soundtrack, amazing animation, but I do think it wouldn't be as great if Nobumoto didn't put so much the people in it, the humor in it, the style of beats. Rewatching Tokyo Godfathers, I was like, that's where I noticed Nobumoto's comedic style, just like the pause on a reaction shot or somebody's big speech and then just like a blank face reaction to it, or just the timing of actions, like it, that so much of that is there for her in her work.
And because Cowboy Bebop is about crime, you can really spotlight a lot of types of people that don't normally get showcased in television or media.
Yeah, they got to do a whole pot episode in a country that really hates pot.
Mm-hmm.
I found a funny quote of hers. Again, this is fan translated, but it's her talking about what her job was on Cowboy Bebop as what I would call the head writer. But she uses the term series compositor. And she says, I have to say, I'm still not sure what a series compositor does. But if Spike said something that he wouldn't say, I'd be the one to say it wasn't right.
Some showrunner, right?
Yeah. Showrunner, yeah. Yeah. I mean,
series compositor, scenarist.
I mean, I guess Watanabe as director was probably where the final call on that would have been made. But I think she was pretty up there with it. And yeah, there's no Cowboy Bebop without Nobumoto. That's for darn sure.
I'm looking at her IMDb. She got a producer credit on the newer streaming series.
That's good. I'm glad. I mean, that would have been like a late check in her career when seemingly she had retired. But yeah, I'm glad she at least got credited. I mean, you know, they went to the trouble of hiring Kano to write new music for it even. Like, they made smart moves on it sometimes, but it just didn't come together.
No one was lazy on that production.
I hate that. I also hated that, like, when she passed away, the show had just come out and people were talking about her in relation to that live action show. Just like, no, guys, we're not thinking about that anymore. That's in the past. Didn't happen. Though unfortunate timing with Bebop entering production, Satoshi Kon wanted her to be the co-writer on his Perfect Blue script, but she just couldn't do it. You know, Bebop, an anime series, is incredibly time-consuming. She could not help Satoshi Kon co-write Perfect Blue.
And I saw after that she was busy being the mastermind behind Kingdom Hearts.
That's correct, yes.
Sorry to steal your fire, Henry. I needed to talk about this.
I know, yes. She is the scenario writer of the first Kingdom Hearts and gets a thank you in Kingdom Hearts 2, yeah.
Our friends at Podcast The Rye just did a podcast about that game, and it was fun to hear outsiders talk about it, when to me the first game has the only story you can actually take apart and understand. After that, it's just like everyone's got secret identities and there are like different universes and there's DLC that explains stuff and some things are just a dream. This is the game where things, it just tells a story that does make sense.
Yeah, it's, you really, now that I see her credits on it, and I've been thinking about it too after hearing that podcast ride, you see what happens when you lose Nobumoto. Like, you lose some grounding with the characters. And to me now, thinking about the first Kingdom Hearts game's plot, it feels like you had these grounded characters with real emotional stakes in it, and then the director of the games kept dumping more and more bullshit on it that eventually just buried it in all the future ones. Like, no, each character in this game has to have six other versions of themselves that exist everywhere else.
We're going to start you off with Roxas. Yeah. How about that?
And then once you meet Ventus, you're like, who even is Roxas to Ventus? Oh, it's his soul that imprinted on a baby that became the dream. When Sora, look, we could get distracted all day with this, but yes, it's, I think probably a big reason people give a shit about Kingdom Hearts' story probably starts with her understanding, like, the trio in that. It's different than the Tokyo Godfathers, but the trio of Riku, Kairi, and Sora do work very well character-wise. Mm. That's why people give a crap about them. But yes, also at the same time, she, for the 2001 Bebop movie, she's also the writer for that, the screenwriter for that film.
Former What a Cartoon, or sorry, past What a Cartoon episode.
That's right.
Former sounds like we just threw it away or something.
So she's very in demand at this time, but this is when she's finally called upon by Satoshi Kon, and she is available after he's wrapped up Millennium Actress in 2001. Here's the funny quote he says about it, getting her. In the joint script, we welcome Keiko Nobumoto, a drinking friend. No, wait. She wrote Hakusen Nagoshi and Cowboy Bebop. The personality of Nobumoto-san, who creates characters with a warm and gentle look, and I, who likes tricky and cowardly material and composition, blend well. Hmm. That's a really great way of putting it. That, like, he does like tricky for sure. Is what he likes to do, which definitely with warm and gentle characters in his tricky compositions, they really do work well together. And so I'm very sad that this is the only film they wrote together.
Yeah, they both have complementary skills and preferences for their storytelling.
I think that's why this is like the most human of his films too. You know, it's not as obsessed with the dreaming machine and the mechanics of it, which that's great too. And also, I mean, Millennium Actress is a very like emotional film, but it is also a film about a love of cinema and a love of art, and almost a character like gives away her humanity in quest for a dream of the art she loves. But this is with the most human of people there are, people who can't even afford to go see a movie, let alone think about it.
They can only afford church. Yuck.
Boo. I guess since you mentioned that too, this is a film where God is real. The Christian God is real.
Yeah. It's full of miracles, which also helps you as a writer because you're like, that could be really convenient, but this is a movie about miracles.
If thematically this film is about miracles, I can have bullshit happen all the time. And I mean, Hana is basically an angel walking on earth.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But He continued to saying, it's a character play. So far, the previous two works were produced and cut to emphasize on the progress of the story rather than the character, or rather due to various restrictions I had to do that. But in the new work, I make scenarios and storyboards with an emphasis on things like the reality that the character is there for. And so, yeah, she, Nobumoto with Kon, co-writes the full script. In one of the extras I saw, they have a picture of, like, here's the full script, and here's his character models of his first designs, and then he started actually composing the rest of it. But Nobumoto, huge part of this, making the characters feel so compelling and alive. So directly after this is certainly her biggest project she ever did, which is Wolf's Rain, which also came out in 2003. And she is said to be the lead creator on it. Like, I found an interview quote with the series director of Wolf's Rain, who even he said, like, no, this is her thing. Like, the lore is all her. The character is all her. Like, this is her world. And
you know, I bet it's good. I think at the time it felt like a real bait and switch for Cowboy Bebop fans. It's like the guy who made Cowboy Bebop, the high octane crime thing that references all your favorite movies. And then the next thing is Wolf's Rain, and it's nothing like that. It's like an emotional storytelling show about a bunch of hunky guys who turn into wolves.
And they're all hunks.
Yeah.
And a lot of cute boys with who also have choker collars on, which I like when attractive men wear choker collars. But,
and I think Space Dandy is really what people wanted from him.
Samurai Champloo was kind of that too. But yeah, Wolf's Rain basically is, it's everybody but Watanabe. Bones is the producers of it and was their first TV series after Bebop. Nobumoto is the writer and scenario director of it, and Yoko Kanno does some amazing music for it too.
Right. It was everybody but him, but I think anime fans at the time thought Bones means Cowboy Bebop, but then we learned Bones is like 8 studios.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going on there.
Well, Watanabe headed over to Madhouse, which is where actually Kon was working on all of his stuff too. I think, too, Wolf's Rain was really hurt by not just those expectations, and then we all got upset because it's not exactly like Cowboy Bebop, but also I think it had a rough broadcast schedule, and, like, the last episodes are, like, clip shows, and they weren't able to end the show until an OVA, and it all sounded pretty messy. People were unfortunately disappointed on it, and I've seen some fans speculate if the poor or less good reception to Wolf's Rain is why she kind of pulled back from anime and anime works and maybe did fewer interviews. But that's just conjecture by fans. She would write some other scripts, mainly on Watanabe shows. She wrote scripts, but wasn't in a head writer position on Samurai Champloo, on Space Dandy, and on Carol and Tuesday. Though from my look at it, she did a lot more live action and prose going forward. And again, a lot of that stuff has, to my knowledge, not been officially released in the United States. So, and I saw her in her interview or her appearance at New York Comic Con in 2018, the videos of that. She seems in good spirits along with everybody else. And, you know, she doesn't make too many big appearances in the U.S. back then. And that was 2018. And then out of the blue, right when people are all talking about the live action Cowboy Bebop, comes the news that in early December of 2021, she passed away from esophageal cancer at the age of 57, which not as young as Satoshi Kon passed away at 46, but still 57, also too young.
Still far too young.
Yeah. It's one of those silver lining things of this tragedy, though, of her passing so young was, especially because people were talking about how good old Cowboy Bebop was then too, I think it made people really appreciate Nobumoto, especially as the writer of the series, and see what she brought to it. That it wasn't just the cool factor that Watanabe brings to it, which he does.
Mm-hmm.
It is the writing and the human characters.
Yeah, show people all these things you like have something in common, and it's her.
Yeah. So rest in peace, Keiko Nobumoto. And this is one of her best works. So I also want to talk quickly about the animation director as well, because they are very important to these things. In the case of, you know, Satoshi Kon, he's director. He did the main character designs to start with, and he does the full storyboards. But the animation director isn't as involved in the creative vision as much as the execution of it and making sure it turns out well. And while Satoshi Kon is also a very good animator, he hired some of the best animators alive at the time to work as his animation director and other senior staff members on it. And the animation director on this is Kenichi Konishi, who also is the main character designer of it, too. There's images out there of, like, here's the original pitch document of Satoshi Kon, where it looks, I'd say, 90% like the characters you see in the film. But if you see it side by side with the poster that Konishi did, you can see what he added extra to it in his character designs. So Konishi was born in 1968, and he was in the top of his class among animation students, hired by Ghibli in the late 80s, early 90s. We've never talked too much about it, but the TV film Ocean Waves, that was supposed to be like the test film of the younger guys, and he worked on that, and it ended up being way more expensive than they meant for it to be.
I still need to see that. I just laugh because we've covered Miyazaki things, and every 15 years, it's like, here's the new generation, and then he's like, no, I'll do it. Let me do it.
Get out of here. Yeah, he can't share. I've got a funny story about that. but he worked on Ocean Waves, then he moved up to Inbetweening on Porco Rosso. But his big, big break came in 1995, and I talked about him a little in it, but in Whisper of the Heart, he did many featured scenes in it, but especially the scene of them all singing Country Roads together, which I love, love, love. He is the credited main animator on that sequence, and it looks amazing. You can see his great sense of character animation and every character playing a different emotion in the scene, and it's about interworking of all these characters, and you can just see, oh, this is the kind of skill he brings to Tokyo Godfathers as the animation director.
Yeah, very high pedigree.
And he also was animating a key animator on Your Mark that same year, which is an amazing music video under Miyazaki as well. And again, he was showing this kind of craft and skill in his mid-20s. He became very in demand as a key animator. He worked on Evangelion's first TV run. He animated, I believe, on episodes 11, 23, and 26. He'd also work on Princess Mononoke, which I think every major animator at the time did at least a couple cuts in. And he worked on the really cool early Mamoru Hosoda Digimon Our War Game. He did that as well. Some really great, funny animation in that one. And so that led to him to a very high-profile position. Pretty much, if you're not Hayao Miyazaki and you're not Isao Takahata, then the highest level you can have at a certain time at Studio Ghibli is to be the animation director on an Isao Takahata film, which is what he did for My Neighbors the Yamadas in 1999. Because Takahata, again, he was the director who couldn't draw, which that was the nickname they had for him. And he could draw, but as in he would draw the storyboards and he knew how to express the story how he wanted it to. But for somebody to actually animate it to make it look like a cartoon, the animation director had way more responsibility than a normal animation director had, which is what Konishi did on that. And after working also on Spirited Away, apparently it was My Neighbor Yamada's that was a big draw for Kon to work with Konishi. He really liked his work on that. From the sound of things, Konishi got hired on to be a support director, animation director on Millennium Actress, but by the end of it, he kind of took over for Takeshi Honda and was the main animation director on Millennium Actress.
I should watch My Neighbors the Yamadas because it was once a novelty that it even came out on Blu-ray, and I bought it when the Studio Ghibli pop-up store happened here 5 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, wow, they have this? And it's still shrink-wrapped.
Because it seemed like Disney was forced by gunpoint to release it. Like, they, in general, they didn't want the Takahata films. They wanted the Ghibli films.
The deal was winding down at that point, I think, right? The Disney deal. Yeah.
That's also why I never thought Only Yesterday would come out here. And that's why my Blu-ray on the shelf is the one I bought in Japan that had English subtitles on it. And then it finally did come out in America.
I have the Japanese Pompoko Blu-ray because I thought it would never come out here.
Yeah, and it did. It just took forever. And Daisy Ridley is the lead voice actress in the dub of that, Only Yesterday.
We've talked about this, but I love seeing the people that had Disney contracts that are dubbing those movies.
Yes. Yeah. I think... the next Ghibli film I want to do is Porco Rosso, and that's because I think it has the best of the Disney dubs, because it's got Michael Keaton and Susan Egan in it as the two leads. Like, yeah, and Cary Elwes. He's the Ronald Reagan type guy in Poker.
Oh, cool,
Rosa.
Cool. I don't think I've heard the dub yet.
It's a good dub.
Or though, maybe I watch it with my wife. I can't remember.
Though apparently the story goes that Miyazaki's favorite dub of it isn't the English or the Japanese. It's the French version, because Jean Reno is Porco.
Of course, of course.
And we know Miyazaki's a real Francophile. But yeah, so Konishi has great collaborative skills at expressing it. Like, he is a masterful animator on his own, and he's also great with working with a group of another amazing animators. Like, he pulled together some amazing people who normally we're used to seeing them put their level of skill of watching, like, a bunch of missiles shoot in the air or, like, a crazy action scene. But here they put that kind of skill. There is some really great action in this movie too, but they really put it to just that level of skill to when Hana just tells off somebody and her facial movements and gesticulations, they're done with the level of skill of like an Akira bike slide. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so well done.
I feel that there are a couple scenes in this movie where they just let the animators do their own style. Like, you'll do a better job if you can just draw in your own style. So just these guys can be wildly off model. We would still know who they are, but it'll look way different.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, get the Blu-ray, guys, because one of the best extras on it is it's about 20 minutes of just Konishi talking over some of the key animation of some of his favorite people who worked on it and giving some behind the scenes. And for the big speech Hana gives that's animated by Shinji Otsuka, Konishi talks about, like, yeah, the eyes are just wrong in a couple of these, but it's just so good. And also it would ruin, the guy did his own in-betweening on it, so they couldn't change any of it.
Mm.
So, but which I'm glad they didn't. It looks amazing.
Yeah, it's memorable.
And so, Konishi would go on to have key roles on Paranoia Agent and Paprika as well. He would also do a ton of work at Ghibli, including animation director on Takahata's final film, Princess Kaguya. And still working into his mid-60s, he is animation director on Fortune Favors Lady Nikuko, which I really want to check out. It looks so cool from the trailers. It's about an overweight woman who has just is a super happy life, and everybody's like, how can she be so positive? It looks really good.
Yeah, I've been looking recently more into non-Ghibli movies that are in Japan. Non-Ghibli anime movies. There are a lot every year, and they're not all like Dragon Ball or Sailor Moon movies. there's a lot going on, and a lot of them get localized and just thrown on a Netflix. No one says anything about them. Or like,
yeah,
HBO Max or whatever. They're out there, and
like
they've been
Penguin
localized.
Highway.
Yeah.
Which at the very least get a little kind of release, which Tokyo Godfathers did not get.